Good morning. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Today's conversation is not about any one politician or political party. It is instead about personality types and how electing people with high conflict personalities can destroy the social and cultural health of a community or a nation. Our primary focus today will be on narcissistic and antisocial personalities and why they are particularly dangerous in the political world. These high conflict personalities in the political realm thrive on division and blame. The traits that most clearly identify a narcissistic leader are the drive to be superior, grandiose thinking, fantasies of unlimited power, and a lack of empathy for others. Antisocial leaders are prone to lying, are highly aggressive, demonstrate a need to dominate others, and show no remorse for their behavior. On today's edition of Line One, Your Health Connection, Bill Eddy returns to the program for a discussion about the global rise of authoritarian-style leaders and discusses how we can use the lessons from the past to identify and stop high-conflict personalities from gaining power and creating social division. Bill Eddy is a lawyer, a licensed clinical social worker, and is one of the world's leading experts on high-conflict personalities. Bill teaches and trains people all over the world on how to manage high-conflict people and is the author of numerous books on the subject, including his newest, Why We Elect Narcissists and Sociopaths and How We Can Stop. Welcome to the program, Bill. I appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thank you so much for having me on, Prentice.
Yeah, we haven't got a little feedback there, so we'll see how that goes. If you have a question or a comment for Bill today, please don't hesitate to join in on the conversation. We can be reached in Anchorage at our local number at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. All right, before we get started on today's topic, let's get a little bit of background from you, Bill, about the work you're doing at the High Conflict Institute and kind of how you got involved in working with high conflict folks. It's interesting you have a background as a lawyer, as a mediator, and as a licensed clinical social worker, so you have sort of varying perspectives on folks and their behavior and what motivates them. So tell us a little bit about what you've been doing and how you got to this place.
Yeah, well, basically, I started out as a clinical social worker, did a lot of counseling in clinics, psychiatric hospitals, worked a lot with children and families and couples. And I found that I really liked conflict resolution part of, you know, helping people in groups, et cetera. And I decided to go to law school to deal with conflict resolution more from the legal side, especially to do mediation, which is really a combination of solving legal problems using some counseling methods, helping people work together. But when I did that crossover, which is now 26 years ago, I became a lawyer in 1993, I discovered that a lot of the mental health problems I saw as a clinical social worker, I was also seeing in legal cases, but nobody recognized them. And so I started talking about that, eventually taught a law school class, wrote a book about that, and suddenly with the internet, people from all over said, we want to understand what's going on. So in 2008, I founded the High Conflict Institute with a woman who'd been working with the court system in Arizona, and I'm in California. And we focused on really training people about how to manage high-conflict personalities in legal disputes. And it's basically personality disorders or traits of those in legal disputes. And that's most of what I've been doing the last 10, 11 years.
So you found out that by understanding that people who were aggressive and angry and didn't seem to have insight, by understanding why they were doing what they were doing, you could figure out how to manage them better.
Exactly. And realizing that the strategies people usually use for solving conflicts don't work with people with these mental health issues, high conflict personalities in particular, that insight just doesn't work with them and actually feeds the conflict. Arguing about the past, you did this, no, I didn't, instead of focusing on what to do in the future. Those types of things really helped for people to understand because they often made the problems worse. And so we teach people how to calm things down and make them better.
Okay, for listeners who might not know much about personality disorders, can you talk a little bit about the personality disorders and why they're different from typical mental health problems, and how do people get personality disorders?
Okay, well, first of all, personality disorders are a disorder in the manual that mental health professionals use and insurance companies use and doctors use for diagnosing mental disorders. But one of the first characteristics is they're generally hidden. It's not obvious. Like depression, anxiety, substance abuse, those are often obvious. You can tell someone's having a problem. With personality disorders, often people can be quite charming at first, and yet not only are they hidden, but they're also interpersonal disorders. So they generally show up in close relationships, and that's a lot of my work has been with divorce. But they also show up in the workplace when there's conflict, crisis, pressure. And so I've done more and more training in the workplace with human resources, EAPs, managers, et cetera, because it is an interpersonal type of conflict. But here's the key things to know about personality disorders. They don't reflect on their own behavior. So they're always seeing all problems as external to themselves. And that means they don't try to change their own behavior. So they tend to have interpersonal problems, don't reflect on their own part, don't change their own part. And that's why they're personality disorders, because they stay in this narrow range of behavior and repeat and repeat and repeat. And that's why things don't get better and why they tend to not have any friends. It's not unusual. They get fired. They get divorced. They're difficult for people to be around over time, especially in a close relationship.
Yeah, the deeper and more intimate the relationship, the more difficulty they have managing those emotions. And it's the lack of insight and the lack of self-awareness that you speak of. So arguing with a person with a personality disorder is like arguing with a drunk person, right? It's a circular process.
Exactly. Exactly. And you, as a mental health professional, I think, know kind of the range of this. But personality disorders really catch people by surprise because they look really normal at first.
Yes.
And that's why people get surprised and hooked into them. And they can be in any profession, in any type of relationship, in every culture. They're everywhere, but usually not seen.
Yeah, I mean, the most obvious, I think people are most familiar with the narcissistic personality disorder, and that one's thrown around a lot, probably way too much. He's a narcissist, but that is one that, you know, the Ted Bundys of the world, very charming, very, will lure you in, often, you know, very good personal skills on the surface level, but then you start to figure out there's something not quite right.
Exactly. And often people can't put their finger on it. But once we teach people about the patterns to look for, especially if they become high conflict personalities, and not all personality disorders become high conflict personalities,
right,
but the ones that do, people really need to learn, oh, this is what's happening. Don't take it personally, and it may be you want to distance yourself, but slowly and gently from this relationship so that it's not quite as intense. But we teach those skills, and then people go, oh, now I see it, and they start making lists in their head. So let me just add something else. If you see this in somebody, don't tell them that you think they have a personality disorder or a high-conflict personality. Keep it in your head.
No, that's a good way to become a target, correct?
Exactly. And it makes things worse. You tell somebody, hey, you've got a personality disorder. They don't go, gee, maybe I do. I should change my behavior. No, they point the finger at you and say, you're a jerk. I never want to talk to you again. Or you are the one that has that. And I've had people tell me that. Say, Bill, if you think I need counseling, you need counseling. That's often a warning sign.
Yeah, they're not going to say, thanks so much for, let me take that into consideration and I'll work on that. All right, if you're just joining us today, my guest is Bill Eddy, who's an expert on high conflict personalities. And today we are discussing his new book, Why We Elect Narcissists and Sociopaths and How We Can Stop. If you have a question or comment about today's topic, please give us a call. Our Anchorage number is 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, we are, let's get into, the first time I saw you, Bill, was at a training for parental alienation, I believe it was, in high conflict people. And how to manage them in legal disputes. And you mentioned that. And then you wrote a book on how to, manage it, and even wrote a book on how to email with people who are high conflict called The Biff Responses, which is great for anybody who just wants to know how to email better with folks. And then Dating Radar, we had a show on that. You've been on a few times. Which was great for how to spot these sort of high conflict personalities before you get too deeply involved with them and have three kids. And now you've evolved into the political realm and looking at high conflict folks in the political world. Can you tell us how this has kind of evolved and why you decided to take on the political question in that world right now?
Well, it's interesting because we started out looking at high conflict people in divorce cases, family law cases. We got asked to teach people and train them in the workplace where workplace disputes. We wrote Dating Radar to help people not get into the relationships they want to get out of. I talked to employers about what to look for in hiring and what to watch out for. And I talked to ordinary people about what organizations you want to give money to and who you're going to invest in. And it just naturally seems to have grown to, wow, now we're starting to see this in politics as well. And it really is a worldwide trend. And so I basically wanted to educate people about what they're seeing in politics now. And it's not just as heads of state, heads of countries,
right,
but at all levels. We had a mayor in San Diego a few years ago that got thrown out of office 8 months after he started because he was basically being a bully, someone who wanted to be in charge of everything, wanted to be the king. We see governors, congresspeople, and of course presidents that start to show these signs, and I think we're going to see more of them. That's a lot of why I wrote this book. It's not just about today. It's about our future if we don't start teaching people what to look for and watch out for.
All right. Before we get to our next point, I want to go ahead. We have our first phone call, so we're going to go to Scott. You have a question. You're on line one with Bill Eddy. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I've been listening to this, and I thought to myself, it sounds like this mental disorder could actually be a really big advantage in the world. Meaning, it seems to me like people with this disorder are very successful. Matter of fact, I can think of several who I believe probably have this disorder, who are multimillionaires and very, very successful politicians. So if I was choosing, and of course we don't have the choice, but if I was choosing, let's say, anxiety, depression, some other disorder, this would be the one that I would want. Now, again, we can't choose our disorders, and many people have a lot of mental problems. Some are very serious.
I'm not hearing a question.
It seems to me like this would be one that in the world of today, and I'm speaking about today, this would give you a great advantage over people with other problems.
Okay. I will relate the question to Bill. He's having some technical problems. But essentially, Bill, Scott asked the question that if he could choose a mental health disorder, he would choose one of these because it seems like many people with narcissism and antisocial personality disorders are successful and, you know, powerful leaders, CEOs, politicians. And what he's saying is it a good thing to have these? But I'm sure you have an answer on why it's not such a good thing. And maybe speak to the difference between having a narcissistic personality disorder and confidence and belief in oneself and the positive sort of narcissism.
Yeah, it's first of all, people really, personalities exist on a continuum. So once it's a personality disorder, you pretty much know the person isn't going to learn, the person isn't going to change, and that means they're going to not succeed in life ultimately. They may in the short term, maybe for a couple of years, they make people think, wow, you're wonderful. But in reality, they crash and burn. In the political world, in the business world, in the relationship world. Now, we all have tendencies to look out for ourselves, to pick ourselves up after a setback, but it really, I don't think, should be called narcissism. I think narcissism really should be a word that's associated with a problem. Now, it may be a small problem, and it doesn't totally sabotage the person's life, but it means that there's something getting in the way of happy relationships, healthy relationships. And so when somebody's got narcissism, it's really not a good thing. Now, some people have a drive, and they have a drive to succeed, and we see them gain status. But the more that they have this as a disorder, the more likely they are to crash and burn. And I've seen this, for example, in the legal profession where I've been involved for 26 years, is lawyers who have this as a disorder, nobody likes them, people don't want to be around them, and they generally fail. They look good for a while, but they generally fail in the long run. Now, people that have some traits, say, of narcissism, but not as a disorder, it may help push them forward. They may get some more power. But as we know, many people that look like they have success and power and wealth in the world don't have friends, aren't really happy. It's all the image. So I think we have to separate the image from what the person's really like.
Right. That's an important distinction. And, you know, I've read some stuff on people with narcissistic personality disorders as CEO leaders. And, you know, the rise up can look really similar to someone who's just an amazing leader and inspires folks. But one of the things that they suffer from is they have high turnover rates. People don't want to work for them. There's lots of infighting in the office. It creates a toxic work environment versus one where people want to follow that leader and are inspired to do great works and make a great company. So, and it's, as you mentioned, it's a very lonely life. You know, a big mansion on the hill with nobody in it.
Exactly. And we have to separate image. And I think image is a big part of why we're getting more narcissistic and sociopathic leaders, because they're good at image, but they're not good at reality. They're not good at the follow through.
Okay, we're gonna get into more of this in the political world. but we're at our first break, so we're going to go ahead and take that. If you're just tuning into the program, my guest today is Bill Eddy, who is an expert on high-conflict personalities. Today we are discussing his new book, Why We Elect Narcissists and Sociopaths and How We Can Stop. If you have a question or a comment about today's topic, please don't hesitate to give us a call. Our Anchorage number is 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752 or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll return to our conversation. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Dare to be the one. A caring adult can make a lasting impact on a child's life. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. Know the signs and help prevent child abuse and neglect. This message sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Bill Eddy, who is an expert on high-conflict personalities. We are discussing his new book, Why We Elect Narcissists and Sociopaths and How We Can Stop. If you have a question, our local number is 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free outside of Anchorage at 1-888-353-5752. And our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. Please remember the show repeats tonight at 8. So if you're listening on this evening, it will be taped and we will not be accepting phone calls. I have a question, an email here from about our narcissistic personalities and other personalized disorders born this way, or is it a reflection of how they are raised in their environment?
Excellent question. And there seems to be three main factors about causes for personality development and for personality disorders. First of all, there's biology. What's our kind of genetic makeup? And some people have somewhat of a tendency towards personality disorders in their genetic family history. So there may be a parent who has a personality disorder and they have four kids and one of them has a personality disorder and the other three don't. In some ways, it's similar to, say, alcoholism.
Right.
And some people have more genetic leaning, but it's not a decisive factor, and that's just one factor. The second part of personality development, of course, is early childhood. First 5 or 6 years of life is when you really learn how to manage relationships, especially close relationships. And ideally, you learn this from a secure attachment with one or both or even more adults, one or both parents or more, like grandparents, aunts and uncles, neighbors, etc. A secure attachment helps someone feel a sense that they're okay, that people are different, you can think different and still like each other, all of that. An insecure attachment, people feel really like more desperate. And when you see people who've grown up with an insecure attachment, in many ways, personality disorders may be attachment disorders. And you see there's a desperation, an intensity that really fits for early childhood, not for adulthood. But insecure attachments may be part of the trend towards, say, a narcissistic personality or a histrionic personality or a borderline personality. And ideally, people get some therapy and may be able to work out some of that early childhood. The last part, though, is culture. And I think this is why we're seeing more people with high-conflict personalities today and personality disorders, is our culture is really teaching and reinforcing bad behavior, bad interpersonal behavior, interpersonal violence, disrespect, insecurity, etc. And it's coming, I think, because so much of our culture today is trying to grab our attention And the way to grab your attention is to show bad behavior. So, for example, our entertainment, movies, TV shows, etc., we seem to pay more attention to the worst behavior. And this is entertaining for adults, but it's training for kids.
Well, even our
three parts.
Even our media headlines and how things are promoted and to grab people's attention. It's this sensationalized media coverage and a focus on the negative and the extreme.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what's interesting, because I've worked with hundreds of people as a therapist and as a family lawyer and now as an educator with, for example, narcissistic personality traits or disorders, some of them you can see how it came out of their childhood. They were abused. They compensated by puffing themselves up and doing extreme things. And other people just came from very normal family, seem to have a secure childhood, and they're just big on themselves. And of course, some people were taught, you've got to be the best. You've got to, you know, you've got to knock everybody else down. You've got to be number one and a winner, and everyone else has to be a loser. And if you grow up that way, that can become part of your personality too.
Okay, can we, your book, Narcissists and Sociopaths, and I use the term antisocial. Can you define sociopath and antisocial and how they sort of overlap?
Yeah. Well, I see antisocial personality disorder and sociopath as basically equivalent terms. And most of the literature treats them as fairly equivalent. So I think what's helpful to know is sociopath may be the more common term, especially, you know, in news about criminals and detective novels and all of that. We talk about sociopaths. Antisocial personality disorder is the way the mental health manual focuses. Both of them think of it as against society's rules. So antisocial is against social behavior. Sociopath is social illness, basically. So it's against society. So both of those terms are fairly equivalent. What they stand for is really aggressive behavior, a drive to dominate other people, to take advantage of them, to get things they have, to get their money, to get sex, to get status, to get reputation from them, to take something. And in many cases, they take people's lives. Most of our murderers, especially serial killers, are sociopaths. Now, there's another level up from that, and that's psychopath, which isn't as common, but seems to have more brutal energy, more willingness to hurt people. But by and large, most people know and have dealt with sociopaths or people with antisocial personalities, but not necessarily known it until they got your money and took off. So that's the most common trait. But they are not just all in prison. They're successful to some extent on Wall Street. You see them, Enron, you see Bernie Madoff. There's now suspicions the Theranos leader has these characteristics. So you see people rise, but then they fall because this drive to dominate, it includes lying and conning and a lack of remorse, a willingness to hurt people.
Yes, but it's important to note that all sociopaths are not murderers, and they're often very charming and just have a tendency towards not caring what they do to get what they want. Let's go to the phones again and see if Bill can hear this question. If not, I will relate it. Jessica, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning, I guess it is. I was just curious. So my sister's in a relationship with somebody who sounds like they have one of these disorders, probably more than narcissistic than anything. And I know that she doesn't want to leave her husband, but what do you recommend for her to make their marriage more happy? I feel like you're talking about how it's always divorce and separating. Is that really the only option?
All right, Bill, did you get that?
Question. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
I heard the question. It's not the only option, and I often encourage people to try and see if they can make it better. Of course, one of the first places in a couple relationship is to suggest couples counseling. It's like, you know, there's some things that aren't working well for me. I'd really like us to get some couples counseling and maybe learn some ways to get along better. And what I'll tell you is people with a disorder, narcissistic personality disorder or sociopathic antisocial personality disorder, there's a real good chance that we will refuse to do that. They will refuse to look at themselves, to consider doing anything different, and they may even get angry at the suggestion. That tells you a lot. And the question to ask yourself then is, 5 years from now, is it okay with me if this relationship is exactly the way it is today? If so, then the other alternative is to make a life for yourself outside of the relationship so that even though you decide to stay, and some people decide to stay because of children or, you know, security or whatever, but getting your good stuff outside of the relationship, having friends, having activities you like so that it's not as intense. The thing I really recommend against is trying to change your partner. It just doesn't work. As most marriage therapists know, you can't change the other person. The other person has to want to try to change as well. And if you don't see that in any way, then that may be a sign that it's time to get some distance or maybe even get out. But it's not always that you have to leave. I think it's worth trying to make it work first.
Yeah, and in working with these folks in marital therapy is really a challenge because the best way to facilitate change is to make them think it was their idea, that they want to do this and that, you know, to appeal to their wisdom and their power and to have them somehow facilitate the ideas and the change. And that seems to be the only approach that I've really found that has much of effect. It sounds like we're halfway through the show and we haven't gotten to our topic yet, really. And I think this next phone call will lead us there. So, Constance, you're on line one. Go ahead. You have she's gone. She had a question, and all I read on it is the president and what do we do? So, moving into the political realm, can you discuss the character traits of high conflict personalities? What do they have in common and how can we recognize them?
Well, the high conflict personalities have four key traits. Number one really is a preoccupation with blaming other people, pointing the finger at other people and never taking responsibility themselves. And that becomes pretty obvious pretty quickly in the political world. There's nothing they can say they would do different, and they're really intense about blaming other people, especially for things that are absurd, that are unrelated to them, or that they could only have a small part in. Second is a lot of all-or-nothing thinking and all-or-nothing solutions. Third is unmanaged emotions. Their emotions take them off course, and they often frighten people. Fourth is extreme behaviors. They do things that 90% of people would never do, and they make a lot of threats that most people would never make, most politicians even. So when you get these four characteristics of a high-conflict personality in a politician, then it becomes worrisome because they have a lot of power to promote things for themselves, and that's exactly what they do. And they tend to hijack political parties to serve their own purpose, which is to be a party of one. And that's why we see them showing up in authoritarian settings. They want to be like a king. I call them HCP for high conflict personalities, wannabe kings. And ultimately, that's their drive, that's their goal, and that's what we're starting to see more of. And as I said, it could be a mayor, could be a governor, could be a president.
All right, we have an email. It says, several years ago, I heard about a study of small children which found a high correlation between the talent for lying and the ability to gather followers. thus suggesting that one of the functional traits of popular leaders is a talent for lying. Is this borne out by your research?
Absolutely true. What I found, and in my book, I looked at 11 different leaders. They were basically national leaders historically, you know, the Hitler, Stalin, and Mao Zedong. They kind of defined how this works. But in the last, you know, really 10 to 20 years, we're seeing authoritarian leaders with these characteristics around the world. So I looked at Putin, Vladimir Putin, Viktor Orban in Hungary, Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines, Maduro in Venezuela, who's making a lot of news for the mess that he's made, Berlusconi in Italy, who kind of set the tone of Italian politics in the 1990s. And then in the U.S., I look at Joe McCarthy, who was a phenomenal liar. He had a strong reputation for lying well before he got into targeting communists in the federal government and the army and the arts. He had a great reputation for that. Then I looked at Nixon, who had a surprising reputation for lying as well. He lied about his wife's birth date. He lied about absolutely absurd things. People didn't focus on that because he also was a politician and they thought it was about politics. But in many ways, his personality made him rise and made him fall. And of course, I do look at Donald Trump because I think he does fit these characteristics. And it's not about politics. It's really a party of one, someone who only has himself in mind. But they use politics as a tool to get themselves into power. And they don't have any loyalty to any party. And many of these politicians, because they're such good liars, have switched parties over the years. And of course, Trump's an example of that. Orban in Hungary is an example of that. Joe McCarthy did that. A lot of these leaders have no allegiance to a political party. They have an allegiance to themselves, and they succeed because they're so good at lying, and they combine that with charm.
Yeah, they might say things like their father was born in Germany when everyone knows that they were not, or obvious lies you mentioned. It seems like let's talk about the blueprint. They switch parties to find the folks that they need to support them. You mentioned in the book, which was a fascinating book and a really good read for anybody who's interested, that is really it's only about 40% of the population, 30 to 40%, that really supports this leader, but it's the division and the infighting that it creates that provides the climate. So can you talk about the blueprint for how these folks come to power?
Yeah, they basically seduce a minority of citizens by telling them they love them, I think, just the way you do. And they often research them and find out what do they want to hear. And then they tell them what they want to hear. It is like dating radar. It's like, I can seduce you because I know what you want to hear, and I'll look like I'm one of you. And so they do that. And then they say, we have to attack a target of blame. So here's an enemy, and I'm going to teach you how to attack them. I'm going to get you to chant against them, to say things against them. So they actually train the people around them to attack their targets of blame. Then they get the people who oppose them to fight with each other. And so they get moderate politicians to fight with what I call the riled up resistors. So the mild moderates say the riled up resistors are just as bad as the high conflict politician, so we're not going to vote for either of them or follow either of them. And then they get a lot of people to be disenchanted and they drop out. So what happens is by dividing people into four groups, loving loyalists, mild moderates, riled up resistors, and disenchanted dropouts, they divide the population and they win. And I saw that over and over again in history and in the elections in other parts of the country. So if they only have 40% of people supporting them, they can still win because they divide the other three groups so that they don't even have 40%.
Yeah, that seems like a, I mean, if you look at the 2016 elections and what's happened since, the infighting and the division of those moderates into like, well, we're going to vote for something different. But the riling up of the troops and the chanting, there's just so many examples. I don't even need to use them, but it's a blueprint that's worked time and time again. And you talked about finding a target of blame. For Hitler, it was the Jewish people who were really comprised less than 1% of the population, if I'm understanding that right.
That's right, yeah. And all of these pick on a small group that's like 1% or less and tell everybody they're super powerful, they're going to take over, they're going to replace you, and that's totally absurd. But they say it over and over and over again, and people start to believe it.
I got another email here, which speaks to this. Says, I can't remember the details, but one of the NPR programs, there was a study done by what type of leadership that young 20-somethings would like to see. It may have been on the media. But the results of the study showed that 35% of young people wanted a leader, a strong leader, rather than a democratic one or someone who listens. Perhaps insecurity, feelings of being isolated from the rest of society contribute. So do these kinds of disorders grow best in a more capitalistic economy as opposed to European and Scandinavian countries, which have better social welfare? So I think it's speaking to the disenfranchised, right?
Well, yes and no. I think, yes, speaking to the disenfranchised, but I think in many ways it's because of our media culture that we teach people that problems are easily solved by a hero. And so we have movies, TV shows, et cetera. In 30 minutes to 90 minutes, there's a terrible crisis, there's an evil villain, and there's a superhero that solves the problem just like that. And I think it's become such a huge part of our culture that we've learned that problems aren't complex. The problems are just bad, evil people. And if we have a strong leader, we can solve those. The reality is, for human beings, we don't like to be told what to do. We like to be independent and free unless there's a crisis. When there's a crisis, then we want a strong leader. And what we've done over the last 30 years is pounded people with how awful the world is and how dangerous and how frightening and this crisis and that crisis, 24/7 news, et cetera, that people really feel frightened. The anxiety level of the general population is so much higher than it was 30 years ago, even. So we have to look at why people want a strong man. Strong man is not the answer. Read my book, History Will Show You, over and over again. It's an image of a strong man. It's really a dictator, authoritarian disaster.
Okay, if you're just joining us, my guest today is Bill Eddy, who is a leading expert on high-conflict personalities. We are discussing his new book, Why We Elect Narcissists and Sociopaths and How We Can Stop. If you have a question or a comment about today's topic, please give us a call in the next 10 minutes so we can get you on the air. Our Anchorage number is 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free anywhere you might be listening at 1-888-353-5752 or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll return to our conversation with Bill Eddy. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and this is Line 1, your health connection.
Funding for Line 1, Your Health Connection, was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you. Dare to be the one. A caring adult can make a lasting impact on a child's life. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. Know the signs and help prevent child abuse and neglect. This message sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning into the program today, my guest is Bill Eddy. We are discussing his new book, Why We Elect Narcissists and Sociopaths and How We Can Stop. If you have a question or a comment about today's topic, please don't hesitate to call in or email. Our Anchorage number is 550-8433. We can be reached toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, we got the phones are lighting up at the end as usual. I got an email that says, is there any way, essentially, if they're not going to change themselves, is there any way to get a leader of this type to motivate them to change their behavior?
The answer is that that's not their capability.
Right.
If they haven't changed in 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years, you're not going to change them. The only thing you can do is rein them in, set limits. Where people have been successful leaders with traits of these personalities is when the people around them have had really strong influence and control over them and have consequences. So they go, uh-oh, better not do this. But what we find is that it usually takes someone outside to shove them out of office. Like I said, we had a mayor here in San Diego who was a Democrat who got pushed out of office after only 8 months because he thought he was the king and everybody should do what he wanted. You see governors, you know, Eliot Spitzer a few years ago in New York. He got in trouble for his spending time with a prostitute, but he really got in trouble because no one could stand him because he was a bully telling everybody else what they should do and how they should think. He, too, was a Democrat. So we have a Republican president at this time. We now know after, I think he declared in June 2015, so we're going on almost 4 years of observing behavior, and you can see how the people around him tried to rein him in, and what he did is got rid of those folks. And if you look at history, that's what authoritarian leaders do. The first thing they do is attack the people around them. And that's what's really unique about high-conflict personalities, is they attack the people close to them. And if you're in a relationship, in the workplace, in business, in politics, you'll be shocked by that. People go, whoa, I thought we were friends. Reading in the history, when Hitler invaded Russia, apparently Stalin thought that he and Hitler were friends. And he's like, how can you do this to me? And, of course, millions of lives were lost in that process. So what we see is that they really turn on people, and it's really hard for the people around to control them. So the answer seems to be better not to give them power and put them in those positions in the first place, whether it's in business, a work group, or politics.
Yeah, you talked a lot about their retribution as leaders, and anybody who stands up to them, questions them, as long as they're doing their bidding and professing loyalty to that leader, they're fine and they're praised and they're good soldiers. But as soon as they question it, then they're eliminated from the ranks and they bring in the next person who will do their work.
Exactly. And it's interesting because they're very good at picking people off one at a time. And the people around them never get organized to really stop the person. That's why it often takes someone from outside. But because I focus on elections in this book, the key is that the electorate needs to know and not elect people like this personality, or if they have, is to vote them out of office, to start seeing. Because the pattern is very narrow. It's this preoccupation with blaming others, all-or-nothing thinking, unmanaged emotions, extreme behavior. And you can go, wait a minute, that's not somebody we want. They might look shiny and exciting now, but down the road they're not going to be.
Yeah, and we're seeing now how difficult it is to apply the checks and balances to this sort of runaway power. But we're going to go to the phones real quick. We have Jana. You're on line one with a question for Bill. Go ahead.
Hi. we recognize that the personality disorders is useful in national politics, but how do we recognize those disorders during campaigns for local and state offices when campaigns are mostly run by TV ads and people don't really know these candidates? They just know them by the gloss rather than by their own personalities, because they don't come and talk to people. They just send mail and have TV and radio ads. It's very difficult, in my opinion.
All right. That's a great question, Jana. Thank you. Go ahead, Bill. You got a response.
Yeah. I totally agree that that's very difficult, and that gloss that the TV ads can put on a person is very misleading. I tend to believe no TV ads. I just go, you know, I'm going to ignore that. The TV ads should have zero impact because they're not information, they're image. But one of the things I have at the back of the book is a list of traits that people can watch out for. And I think this is where, you know, the media can be really helpful, is doing some research and seeing, does this person have a pattern of making personal attacks? Do they tend to have crisis emotions? Do they have a lot of all or nothing solutions? Do they seem self-absorbed? Do they seem to lack empathy for the situation of others? Do they misjudge others? Do they think someone's their friend who's not? And this is where you get into world leaders that like each other when they're authoritarian. Why would a democratically elected official really like an authoritarian official? That's often a question, because they'll turn on them. That's, they don't. There's no honor amongst authoritarian leaders. Sees themselves as a big hero. If they speak of themselves as a big hero individually, only I can fix it. That's a warning sign, and doesn't play well with others. So I think in many ways it's watching out for the language they use, whether they're preoccupied with blaming others or they actually talk about solving problems. And to me, the number one question is, can they learn? Have they ever learned that something they were doing wasn't good, or a position they had wasn't good, and they've learned and changed and grown? And a lot of politicians can't do that, but a lot of them can. And that's a big warning sign right there.
It's important on the local level, thank you for the question, Jana, to really educate yourself about the background of these folks who are running for these offices. What sort of institutions have they run before? Because often they're, you know, they have a history or a pattern. Have they held a lot of jobs briefly? Have they had a history of, yeah, like you said, attacking other, blaming other people for the problems, not being accountable in the work environment or in, you know, in other experiences they've had? So I think educating yourself, and as she pointed out, not listening to the gloss and to the message is important. So we're going to go ahead and go to Kevin. You have a question for Bill. You're on line one. Go ahead.
Hi. Mr. Eddy hasn't really provided any treatment solutions for people with personality disorders when they do seek treatment. Wondering what the opportunities are when they do have the search for a better lifestyle.
All right, Kevin, that's a good question, and we haven't gotten to that because this isn't really a personality disorder show, but it sounds like there's a lot of interest, Bill, in doing that, so maybe we could have you back on to do more of that. But give him an answer real briefly.
Yeah, real briefly, that's the problem, is if they have a personality disorder, they don't look at themselves, they don't feel they need to change. But with that said, of the five high-conflict personality disorders, or ones that tend to be that way, borderline personality disorder is one that does get into treatment sometimes, and there's been success with that. I think anybody seeking mental health treatment can only benefit themselves. The problem with these folks is they don't. But if they do, yes, there is treatment. A lot of cognitive behavioral methods can help people change and improve. And some narcissists do later, like 40s and 50s later in their lives, realize, hey, I need to work on myself. Sociopaths don't, and mostly people with personality disorders don't even seek treatment. They just fight against the idea that that would benefit them.
Yeah, Kevin, my experience is that people with personality disorders get into therapy when they are in trouble. If there is a legal mandate, a judge says you have to go to therapy for some DV situation, that is the time they get into treatment. So if I have somebody who voluntarily comes into my office and they say, I think I'm a narcissist, I have a narcissistic personality disorder, and I'd like to get some help with that, I say, well, you probably don't have it then, if you came in and volunteered that.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's been your experience. So last couple of minutes, how do we thank you for the call, Kevin. That's a great question. I'd like to have Bill back on to really dig into personality disorders a little bit more sometime in the future. So we'll put that on the queue. How do we avoid, I guess you said the best way to do it is to avoid electing them. And besides educating ourselves and really looking for their character traits, how do we talk to folks? How do we engage in a dialogue that fosters or brings people around to this? Is there any way to change the loyalists?
Well, my experience is the loyalists are not the place to focus, because there is a tendency, about 30% of the population really does like the idea of a strong man leader and will follow the leader and to some extent become infatuated with the leader and have an emotional connection. And you can't really talk people out of that. It's like having a friend who's dating a con artist and everyone else can see it, but they can't.
Right.
So I think it's better to focus on mild moderates, riled up resistors, and disenchanted dropouts, and help them see how they all share an interest in not having a high conflict politician in charge of their lives, and to look at not getting divided. It's very easy for riled up resistors and moderates to start criticizing and maybe even hating each other. And this is what high conflict politicians specialize, is sowing divisions between people, and to see when it's happening and to say, wait a minute, let's not buy into that. And sometimes you'll see a high conflict politician pounding on one candidate and totally happy with another, because they know that's going to divide them. And we've seen in elections and recent elections, and this has been true in Europe as well, is the opposition gets divided. And when they unite, they are able to block and either vote out or prevent high conflict leaders getting elected. So there is some success around the world to look at. We're starting to see that in some of the recent elections in Europe.
All right, Bill, that's all the time we have for today. I really do appreciate you joining us today on Line One.
My pleasure.
All right, take care, and we'll talk soon. Be sure to join me again next week, when my guest will be Anchorage writer and educator Julia O'Malley. We will be discussing the pros and cons of social media and how technology is impacting the social and emotional health of society and is shaping our cultural norms. Be sure to tune in and learn more next Wednesday, May 1st at 10 o'clock, repeating at 8 on FM 91.1 Alaska Public Media. My thanks to Ammon Swenson, who is our audio engineer, and to our producer, Zakia McCummings. For all of us at Line One, thanks for taking the time to join us. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.